Welcome to PracticalHematologist.com. My name is Jim Armitage, and I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And today, I'm joined by Dr. Loretta Nastipil, who is a lymphoma expert and an associate professor at MD Anderson Cancer Center. These are our disclosures. Today's presentation will address disparities in care for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, the most common lymphoma. In this presentation, Loretta will discuss key data from recent publications and conferences on disparities in care for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and describe current and potential practice implications, and will then conclude by discussing best practice. This is not a trivial issue, and it's becoming increasingly clear that there are significant disparities. I will now turn the floor over to Dr. Nastipil.
Thanks, Dr. Armitage. And I think diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is a great area to really dig deep into racial disparities, mostly because most patients should anticipate a cure with standard therapy. So this does give us the opportunity to really explore, is that true for all patients? What we know about diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and race is that Black patients with large cell lymphoma often present at a younger age, with more advanced stage, and actually have inferior survival. Interestingly, patients with large cell lymphoma, including Black patients, are more likely uninsured, more likely to have Medicaid insurance, less likely actually to receive chemoimmunotherapy. And I'll show you the data that backs up those statements. I think health disparities is a very complicated issue. It's a complex interaction from a number of variables, not only patient demographics, but also socioeconomic status, where these patients reside, access to healthcare, not only at the time of diagnosis, but potentially preventative strategies, early detection, access to what we would consider good quality standard of care. But there's probably also some underlying underpinnings of the biology of the disease that may describe some of these disparate outcomes. It's important to explore all of these variables if we really do intend to minimize these disparate outcomes and either influence policies or access to care for all patients. So I mentioned that African-American or Black patients present at a younger age. So this is SEER data looking at the age of diagnosis according to race. And you can see here outlined by the blue bars, those are white patients. The red bars are Black patients. And then green is other. And you can see this age of distribution. You see younger patients or patients that were Black presenting at a younger age. And that looks quite starkly different to me than those patients with who are white who present primarily in their 60s to 70s. We also know that survival is different. Again, looking across the National Cancer Database according to race, not only large cell lymphoma, but other hemolignancies such as CLL and Flick lymphoma. So when we look at race and gender, so Black males tend to have the worst survival, particularly with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, even less favorable than Black female patients, but both do worse than white male or female patients. Again, highlighting that these patients are facing inferior survival, both at 2 years, 5 years, and even 10 years. Is there underlying biological differences that may explain these disparate outcomes? One approach to try and address this was a large study where they performed whole exome sequencing to look at underlying, again, biological drivers of this disease, and they had a comparison with those of European ancestry versus African ancestry versus other. And you can see there were actually genes that were statistically more significantly found in patients of African ancestry, and they're outlined on this slide, suggesting that there is indeed some differences in the underlying drivers of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Now again, how we might translate that into clinical practice, we need a larger validation set and we need more information how to potentially identify these genes and whether or not treatment should be modified as a result. But it does shed some light, at least in my opinion, that again, this is a complex issue. It's not just access to care, but also potentially some underlying biological differences. But biology doesn't explain this in isolation. As I also mentioned at the onset, the type of insurance patients have is also associated not only with survival, but access to care, including therapies like stem cell transplant. So patients who are privately insured have better survival. And again, Black patients or Hispanic patients were less likely to receive standard of care stem cell transplant, potentially considered a very resource-rich therapy, again, suggesting that many of these patients may have barriers to access to care. One study we set out to look at was when you have a drug like rituximab that has clearly altered the natural history of this disease, improving survival for patients, do Black patients have the same access to care? So utilizing the National Cancer Database, we looked in the early years following the introduction of rituximab into the treatment landscape of large cell lymphoma and demonstrated that Black patients were less likely to receive chemoimmunotherapy. So again, that's rituximab in combination with an anthracycline-based treatment, but also less likely to receive chemotherapy altogether. Now, again, there were additional factors such as insurance status, socioeconomic status, but being Black and being over the age of 60 resulted in the observation that they were less likely to receive chemoimmunotherapy. Again, and this was in the setting where we knew that these agents potentially could improve survival. Again, distinguishing this from insurance status and access to care is quite complex, but once again, Black patients and those that were underinsured, either having Medicaid or no insurance at all were independent variables that were associated with inferior survival, suggesting that we may need to address policies that provide equal and equitable access to adequate insurance that may then translate into better treatment options. Also, where patients reside impacted their survival. So looking at patients that resided in rural areas that may not have access to specialized centers that have expertise in these rare tumor types also were associated with outcomes. So actually quite interesting, patients with large lymphoma that resided in a rural area were more likely to receive treatment within 14 days of diagnosis. Now that may seem as a misconception about being associated with less favorable outcomes, but we know that patients with large cell lymphoma who have a longer time from diagnosis to initiation of treatment actually do more favorable. That may suggest that these patients get diagnosed at an earlier time point in their disease course where they have the luxury of setting up staging and treatment in an outpatient setting, whereas patients who may not have access to adequate care may present at more advanced stage and need to initiate treatment much more urgently. And again, we know that early initiation of treatment has been associated with less favorable outcomes. Again, this probably speaks to whether or not patients have access to care and just more data suggesting that those that are uninsured or even Medicaid insured tend to have less favorable outcomes than those who are privately insured. So to summarize, these outcomes based off of what we perceive to be access to good quality care, Black patients are often uninsured or have Medicaid insurance, and that has been associated with less favorable outcomes, more advanced stage at presentation, more likely to receive treatment within 14 days of treatment. And this suggests that we may need to do a better job of providing adequate coverage and access to minority patients. We do know that when patients have access to the same level of care, they tend to have similar outcomes. And one way to address this is looking at the VA data set of patients, given that these patients should have access to similar care despite where they reside, or again, removing the variable of insurance status. And you can see, at least in this data set, race was not associated with outcomes, further emphasizing that, again, if patients have access to the same care, you can actually achieve similar outcomes. The other thing that's important to recognize is that minority patients are often underrepresented in clinical trials, which may provide additional benefit, particularly in those later lines of treatment, which may also have an impact on overall survival. So again, looking at the NCI data sets, patients who were Hispanic or Black were much less likely to enroll on a prospective therapeutic study. And when we break that down further and look specifically at trials treating hematologic malignancies, again, very stark difference in Black patients participating in large cell lymphoma studies versus even AML and ALL. And again, that looks quite different when you consider that in the context of solid tumors. I'll draw your attention to the lung cancer cohort, suggesting that much more comparable participation on studies than what we see in our heme malignancies. Now, it's important to recognize that the incidence of heme malignancies among Black patients might be lower than some of these solid tumors, but I do think draws attention to the fact that we need to do a better job of providing access and enrolling patients on prospective studies. And the last thing I'll cover, CAR T-cell therapy has transformed our approach to relapsed refractory large cell lymphoma. And similar to the analysis we did looking at the introduction of rituximab into the treatment landscape, do Black patients or minority patients have similar access to these novel therapies that are now entering into the treatment landscape? This was data presented by Fred Locke on behalf of his co-authors, an analysis of the CIBMTR database. And you can see here the distribution of patients by race across the U.S. Again, minority patients tend to be more commonly treated at centers along the East and West Coast as opposed to the middle of the country. Again, identifying disparate practices. When we look at baseline characteristics according to race, and again, these were all patients that were considered or treated with CAR T-cell therapy, similar to what we've seen in other data sets, there's less representation among Black patients in that 65 years or older age cutoff. They're more likely to have comorbid conditions, including moderate to severe pulmonary comorbidities. Interestingly, less likely to have a prior cancer than wider Asian cohorts. And a higher percentage of patients had a longer time from diagnosis to infusion. Now, again, that may suggest more favorable disease biology. It may also suggest barriers to access to care. You look at the percentage of patients that were more than 28 days from leukapheresis to infusion, slightly higher percentage number among the Black versus Asian or white patients. How does this impact outcomes in terms of efficacy? Outlined in this slide, you can see the objective and complete response rates broken down according to race. White and Asian patients had higher objective response rates and complete response rates. The Black or African American race objective response rate was 57% versus 74% among white patients, and a slightly lower percentage achieving a complete response. When we look at PFS according to race, African American or Black patients had inferior progression-free survival versus those that were white or Asian. We don't see those disparate outcomes when we look at ethnicity, looking at Hispanic versus non-Hispanic. Fortunately, overall survival is no different in this cohort of patients, suggesting despite having inferior PFS, survival is no different, suggesting these patients were potentially able to go on to subsequent therapy. So I'll conclude by highlighting there are racial disparities in large cell lymphoma, a disease where many patients should anticipate potential cure, and it's likely multifactorial. In addition to differences in the baseline disease characteristics with less favorable prognosis at the onset, Black patients tend to have less access to standard of care options that potentially are curative options. They're more likely to be underinsured or uninsured. They're less likely to have access to a clinical trial. So what do we need to do to try and reverse or improve these disparate outcomes? We need to do a better job of ensuring these patients have access to good quality of care. What we're doing right now is getting the message out so that there is knowledge and awareness that may impact local practices. In addition, there are resources that we're exploring to try and recruit or enhance recruitment of minority patients, particularly to novel therapies where we think might provide improvement to the treatment landscape. And we need to continue to explore the underlying biologic underpinnings that may then inform differences in treatment approaches. But with this, I'm happy to turn it back now to Dr. Armitage and continue the discussion.
All right, Loretta, thank you. That was a wonderful presentation, and this leaves us all sorts of things to talk about, which we can do for the next few minutes. The issue of getting minorities into clinical trials is complex. Some years ago, I led a a review group, and we produced a white paper for the National Cancer Institute about how to improve participation in clinical research for patients with cancer. And one of the interesting things is that all minority groups are not the same in this regard. If you want to take gay people as a minority group, they were extremely interested in this issue and perhaps more likely to want to be part of it. This was during the time of the HIV epidemic, and they were very interested in learning how to do better with that. Black people were the opposite. And we had the head of the National Medical Association, so a senior leader in medicine, but for black physicians, speak to us. And he said that you have to understand that black people often just don't trust you. They all know the story of the syphilis studies of the many years ago, and they don't feel that they're likely to get a fair break, and they don't want to be a guinea pig. It hurt my feelings to know that people felt like that, because I don't think we did that. But it doesn't matter what I think. It matters how we make the patients respond. How do you try to address those issues?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is recognizing we have maybe unconscious biases, and you're right, people are going to view clinical trials from the prism that they, their culture, their history, and what they view might be the outcome for them personally. One thing that we've tried to incorporate is having staff, we tend to call them patient navigators, that may look like patients and speak like patients that we're trying to communicate effectively with, that may then explain clinical trial risk in language or speech that they feel more comfortable with. They may even feel more confident asking those uncomfortable questions, just like you mentioned, am I really a guinea pig? Will I tend to benefit? What is the risk to me if I participate in this study? The other thing that I think we have to acknowledge is oftentimes minority patients, again, if they're underinsured or they don't have adequate access to care, they may also be providing support not only to their immediate family, their elders, their kids, and they may not be able to miss time from work to participate on study, and we have to reduce the barriers in terms of number of visits, number of hours that we monitor patients post-infusion to try and minimize the time away from work, or explore resources where we might be able to supplement, not directly as a sort of an opportunity to profit per se from participating on a study, but at least reduce that barrier of transportation, parking, missing work, or providing care for an elderly or a child because they're not there to take care of them. I think we need to have people who can have that conversation with patients in a way that they feel comfortable disclosing that, so that we can approach this from multiple angles and again try and minimize that barrier and perceptions about, you know, what the risk is to them as an individual.
Those actually are wonderful thoughts, and you're putting them into practice, which means you probably have data before you started to do that and after you did that, and showing that that actually improves participation would be important, perhaps. Okay, another thing. I'm going to talk a little bit about which issues that are unique but need to be thought of in this situation. Are there minority groups where you have to, you particularly worry about drug metabolism and being unable to safely use the same agents? And how do you address personal beliefs or family beliefs? Sometimes religious beliefs would alter people's willingness to participate. Would you want to comment on those two issues?
Yeah, I think doing more of those whole exome sequencing or whole genome sequencing projects where we have better representation from minority subgroups is one way to get to the question of how does the underlying biology impact things like metabolism and toxicity? Because I think that's what most patients are fearful of. They don't want to have a toxic outcome, and they want to tend to benefit from participating on a study. And that's why it's so critical that we get more heterogeneous patient population so that we can do a better job of informing, you know, what is the potential risk. I think it's also critical to be able to communicate to folks in ways that they don't feel either patronized or they don't understand, and they don't feel comfortable enough to say, wait, stop, repeat that, or can I ask you a question so that I fully understand? And I do think having training in terms of how to communicate things, having more staff that looks like the patients we want to try and do a better job recruiting to studies. Meaning, can we do a better job of recruiting minority oncologists, for instance? Can we do a better job of having our APPs and nurses be more reflective of the population we hope to serve? So I think those are some sort of strategies that we have an impact on. I think making sure that patients feel like they are contributing to the general well-being of others, and how can we share the information back to them? I think we do a poor job of communicating back. You participated on this study. As a result of this, this is now a therapy that's available for more people. So can we provide them more feedback of the benefits of participating, but also recognize our blind spots or our biases that we think all clinical trial participation is good, and we just need more minority patients on those studies?
I appreciate your comments. You made me think of one thing was, if you want to try to help somebody understand this, you probably would be better off if you take the time to not be in a hurry, be their friend. In fact, some of my best friends are patients I've cared for in the past. I think just taking the time to do that is rewarding for you too, but it's they're more likely to take seriously and listen to what you say, I believe. And I think it's useful to keep your hands off the computer while you're doing it. Anyway. All right, next thing. Language, at least for me, can be a nuisance. You probably have more experience than me of having to do H&Ps and have interviews and discussions with patients with whom you cannot talk to them in their native language. How big a barrier do you think using an interpreter is, and how do you get around it?
Well, I think it's incredibly important that when we're talking about risk and particularly consent forms, it has to be conveyed in their native tongue and not by a family member. Technology has helped in a lot of ways, but it's also probably hindered the process. So through technology, and what I mean by that is in our institution, we have the ability to FaceTime with interpreters, translators across a number of languages. And so you at least get that visual cue where you can see a person speaking. The problem, as you mentioned, is it inherently adds more time to that visit because there's going to be a delay of the patient communicating to the translator, they communicating to the physician, me communicating back to the translator, and then it getting conveyed to the patient. And I have to catch myself all the time because I want to interject or I want to start speaking before all parties have the opportunity to finish that communication. But I think it is really key that we do communicate in the native language and explore technologies that are available that can help. I think for more common languages like Spanish, for instance, in a center like ours, we're in Texas, we do make an effort to have written information in Spanish that we can provide. But for some of the other, particularly Asian-based countries, we're not as good in that regard. And so we try really hard to have someone in person walk them through that written consent form. And I would say pre-COVID, it was much easier. We had a number of staff on site. Now in the COVID and post-COVID era, we're relying much more heavily on technology where it can be done virtually. And I think we lose a little in that, but I think you highlighted something really important. We just have to be more patient.
All right. Thank you. As usual, you have thoughtful, good advice. How about a more complicated issue that the two things I'm going to suggest you probably have some experience with, people who are incarcerated, and how do you address the issues that come from that? And you have to have lots of undocumented patients you see. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, two really complicated issues. So I think the important thing for people who are incarcerated is we have to, whether they're incarcerated, that's one unique population, but even what about patients who feel desperate that they need something that's going to work for them. I think they both highlight two important groups. We need to make sure that patients are actually providing informed consent and they're not being pressured into doing something either as the expectation that they need it to benefit them, otherwise they're going to die from their disease, or they don't really have a say because they, again, are in a situation where they don't have autonomy over their day and their routine. So I think obviously, we don't have many experiences with enrolling prisoners on studies. Generally, it's viewed that they really don't have the autonomy or the freedom to be able to control their time and provide informed consent for participation. But I think what I face more often that I think is similarly important is I want patients to go on study because I think it's important I do trials. I'm clearly biased towards clinical trials. I have to step back and make sure, is that the right thing for a given patient? Because we all know there are phase one first in human studies that were super optimistic about the mechanism of action, but there's some patients that start at dose level one, and we know they may not truly benefit from that. So I think that's another situation that is in line with what we're asking here. How do you juggle the need and the want to put patients on trials because you feel strongly about it versus their freedom and autonomy to make the right choice?
I talk to patients about that, and about the two reasons to be on the study are you want to benefit, and very few people would be on one, they weren't hoping for that, but also altruism. And I think everybody doesn't always realize how brave these people are trying to make it better for people in the future. But anyway, go ahead.
I think the last group you touch on is, what about patients that are not insured in the U.S., or at least based off of our standard coverage for healthcare? That's a much harder problem, and we do have these situations. In the U.S., patients can present through an emergency situation, and we're obligated and we should provide care to them. Where I struggle the most is, okay, if I initiate them on treatment because they have a potentially curative lymphoma, but yet I can't follow them in the clinic because their insurance is not covered by, you know, our contracts and negotiations, it's quite a bit of effort to try and find practices within the Houston area where I can get them plugged in, where they can continue on that care. And this is something, it's a dilemma we face not infrequently. And so I think most people who are undocumented, they're super nervous about the legal implications of that. And oftentimes they don't want to disclose that information. And so I think being mindful of making sure that they feel comfortable that we really are trying to help them, we're going to explore every avenue available to us. And there are potential resources as long as they can provide some form of documentation. So again, I think it all boils down to how we communicate, and really having phenomenal social workers and case managers that can really explore every single avenue.
Yes, it's a lot of things they didn't teach you in medical school. But people that you see with these diseases have every right to believe that their interests are all you care about, and you'll go out of your way, and my line is you'll do anything that's not grossly illegal or immoral to advance their interests. And when people believe that that's how you're going to treat them, you're a better doctor, and you also get farther in the things we're talking about. That was wonderful, Loretta. It's exactly what I thought you would do. Thank you very much. I tremendously enjoyed listening to it, and I really enjoyed your answers to the controversial issues. And I hope you have a great rest of the week. And we both, Loretta and I, want to thank you all for viewing this activity. We hope you enjoyed it and gained from it.
Thank you. I really appreciate also spending time with you, Dr. Armitage.